Welcome to You Don't Know the Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and today I'm looking for an unteachable book. To help me are my friends Ian and Joe, two English teachers.
I'm Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, today I have a book that I would never bring in my classroom. Or, I mean, I'd probably be fired. I think you should read Pimp, the Story of Iceberg Slim.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a book which I wouldn't assign in school, I think you should read Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by the man, the myth, the legend, the pen name, Mark Twain.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Would you like a fun fact about Mark Twain?
Yeah, please.
All right.
Yes.
His real name was Samuel Clemens.
Yeah.
His middle name was Langhorne.
That's more fun.
It reminds me of Foghorn Leghorn, but it's not the same.
Foghorn Leghorn.
I've never seen them in the same time, place at the same time, but I think they're different.
Is that why they had like the Southern accent? Like, I say, because that's how Mark Twain talked.
Oh, absolutely.
And we don't really have any evidence of Mark Twain ever saying, and I quote, I say. Yeah. Hey, actually, you guys, I have a legitimate fun fact. So Mark Twain spent a lot of time traveling around the West, and he's kind of most known for some of his stories about California, like the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County. But much of his early newspaper career, he spent about 30 miles from where I am sitting right now in a little town called Virginia City up in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I have a more fun fact than
that. Well, I wasn't done.
There's got to be one more fun than that.
Nick, I think you'll like this. Mark Twain gets his name. So as you know, Mark Twain is not his real name. He gets his name from when he was working on steamships in the Mississippi River. And Mark Twain is a measure of depth, right? Something about lowering the rope into the water. And once it reached a certain...
Throughout your sounding line. And the weight on the end would be greased with tallow, so you would pull up whatever the bottom of the river is, and there are marks on the rope to see how deep it was. And Mark Twain is 3 fathoms deep, right at the mark, and sorry, two fathoms deep, right at the mark, and Twain meaning two. He heard that, and he said, that's a good name.
Yeah, so do you think like it just sounded like a good name to him, or do you think this is the equivalent of somebody naming themselves like 4 miles or something like that?
Inch marker.
Do people name themselves 4 miles?
Is
this a character in your novel?
Is this a rap name?
That was Eminem's original name, was 8 miles.
I think he probably just said it sounds like a good name.
Fighting over Mark Twain facts right now.
Can I finish my fun fact, please?
Did you start it?
Yes, I did. I was giving you background.
Let's just start calling these facts.
That's true. It is a truth universally acknowledged that none of the things we've called fun facts on this show have ever been fun. The Ulysses episode out? The Ulysses episode has a lot of quote-unquote fun facts, which are mostly just like, he struggled with a disease.
This is probably a good opportunity to just talk to our audience real quick and apologize for any continuity errors between the first couple episodes. We have no idea what we're doing, and these were released and recorded in completely different orders, so we apologize.
Random. It's no, Nick, you got to frame it right. It's all about frame. It's the story you tell. Okay, hey, listeners, guess what? Guess what? Who doesn't like a treasure hunt? The treasure you're hunting for is sense. You're trying to make sense of this jumble of podcast episodes. To do this, follow the clues we've traced. We've tracked the clues.
We've hidden clues all over Apple Podcasts.
Well, mostly just our podcast. Sprinkled through the episodes which are shortly to be released, or maybe will be released in several months.
Who knows?
If you can find them, you win the prize of understanding.
Now that we've gone live, and the legions of fans are coming out of the woodwork and clamoring to our beautiful, beautiful art that we've created that we call this podcast. Can we name our fans?
Oh my gosh, no. It's got to be natural. It has to be natural.
Okay.
Litheads. Call them litheads.
Litheads.
I have one, but
Go for it.
I have one. No, you're right, Ian. It should come up naturally. So let's keep going, and I'll just naturally try to bring it up.
Okay.
That'll be the only thing I'll be focusing on for the next hour.
Great. I think Joe really likes lit heads.
All right. Guys, I'm pretty excited about the books that you have.
Great.
I think we're both excited.
Okay, good. Yeah. All right. That's all I got.
Bringing that real Monday morning energy to this podcast. Well, okay. Before we start, can we talk really quick? I'm talking like really quick about the sort of the word unteachable and kind of how we interpreted that, because I kind of think maybe Joe and I interpreted that slightly differently. And I think maybe Nick maybe didn't.
I can clear this up.
Oh, great. This is famous last words.
Let me help. Unteachable, like we discussed in detail last week. Unteachable is like, what are some books that you like, but you probably can't tell your kids about, your students about?
So yeah. I approached this. Go ahead, Joe.
No, I was just going to say, and I think the spirit that I took it in is I tried to find a book that I think is super interesting and I think is absolutely worth reading. But if I, as a teacher, brought it into my classroom, I would lose my job, right? Or I would hear from parents and like I'd be sitting down with the with administration.
Are these the naughty books?
This is I brought a naughty book.
Are there curse words in it?
Oh yeah.
Ooh.
So like this has to be books that Joe and books that I can't teach. Not necessarily the books that are impossible to teach or that people shouldn't teach. So like the struggle I came up with was like, I have taught college in the past and there are things that I would teach in college that I can't really teach in high school.
100%.
There are things I would teach to a graduate class, a class of graduate students that I wouldn't teach to like a sophomore English class in high school.
Yeah, so, I don't think anybody's saying they're unteachable physically.
But that made me think about, that made me wonder if there is such a thing as a objectively unteachable book.
Well, let's say this. You can teach things without preaching things, right?
Ooh, like, good, yes.
Yeah, so like, of course, so like if you teach Mein Kampf, like there's never even a suggestion of, hey, this guy's got some pretty interesting ideas, right?
Right.
But it's like, hey, this is a valuable thing to be aware of so that, well, for whatever reason.
You never know. I've been pushing this podcast to all my friends because you just never know where you're going to get a devout listener.
That's true. A lit head.
A lit head. A loyal litener.
Ooh, that just sounds like you kind of mispronounced it a little bit.
No.
Should we like tell quickly about what our books are about and then Nick, you can choose who goes first or what?
Yeah, let's do our 30-second overview here.
All
give
right.
us. Give me 30. Which book was written first?
Mine.
Yep.
Yep.
by like, I think almost 100 years.
By 100 years, yes.
All right. Ian, give me your 30 seconds. Hold on.
Okay.
Let me cue it up.
Start the clock.
Cueing in 3. All right, go.
Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is a book by Mark Twain. Published in 1885. It's a novel about young man from Missouri who travels with an escaped slave down the Mississippi River, and this is before the Civil War. They encounter a variety of colorful characters and crazy events, including a Hatfield and McCoy style feud and a couple of con men who are just horrible. Huckleberry Finn, the main character, kind of
sorry.
Okay.
We got to follow these rules. Yeah. If there's nothing more enjoyable than fake rules that are strictly enforced.
Strictly adhered to, yes.
I will say that the strictness of the enforcement is a benchmark of this podcast.
Absolutely. Yes.
We follow our rules.
If this is your first rules, episode, yes.
Regulations and cold hard facts.
And then speculation. Mostly speculation.
Ian, you didn't tell me anything about the naughty bits. Nothing.
Well, I was about to, but
maybe we'll start doing 31 seconds so you can get to the good parts.
Well, the kind of
now your time's over. Joe, are you ready?
Is that Huckleberry Finn moves
Stop.
From dismissive racism to
I'll
a nuanced
this
view
later.
Of black humanity?
You can't strong arm your way into this. Joe, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Your time starts right now.
Pimp, The Story of My Life by Iceberg Slim is the lifelong story of a man, of the man who made pimping iconic. Nick, I think everything you know about pimping today started in this book. It has influenced hip-hop culture. It has influenced celebrities. It has influenced people like Snoop Dogg, Dave Chappelle, Cat Williams, Ice-T, Ice Cube, and Chris Rock gives it as a gift to everybody he works on a movie with. Pimp codified the pimp archetype and brought... dang, I had three words left.
Oh, no, three words.
Yep.
This is not good. Joe.
Brought
Joe
it to mass culture.
31 seconds.
Joe, you and I need to stage a rebellion because the power has clearly gone to Nick's head.
He's going to be signing an executive order and it is going to be 30 seconds, no more.
As your editor, I have complete autonomy. So I don't know where I was going with that, but yes, the power has gone to my head. It's fun to save the best for last, but let's start with Joe's because I'm the most enticed there.
All right.
Before we start with Joe's, maybe Nick can tell us everything he knows about
pimping,
running a band of sex workers.
Yes.
Because Joe said everything you know about pimping comes from this. So, like, Nick, what do you know? Walk us through it, please.
I don't think we have enough time on this episode get through all of
pimping. You did just tell us you were the editor and you could control all that stuff. So how about you do your job?
Nick, do your job.
Here's the only thing I know about Joe's book. It was mentioned in a wonderful Dave Chappelle stand-up, and that was the first time I ever heard of it, which was, a year or two ago on Netflix. And it was one of the ones where he came back and did like a couple stand-ups for Netflix. Anyway, that was the first time I heard of it. It sounded awesome because he does like a whole bit on it. And then I completely forgot about it. So, Joe, tell me about your book.
Yes.
Sure, I'll listen intently this time.
So if that Dave Chappelle episode that you're talking about, that Dave Chappelle special you're talking about, is also the first time I heard of this book. Pimp is an autobiography, a memoir, about this young guy born in the Midwest and growing up in the Midwest during the Depression. He is a young black guy, and he looks around him at the world, and he tries to see a way for a black man to make a living in which he doesn't have to work for white people. Right? That's a big theme throughout this. Like, he wants to be able to make a living in which he is basically outside the system.
Does he succeed?
Great question. He tries a few different things. He bootlegs at one point. This would be during Prohibition, and he is expelled from college and later goes to prison, right? In prison, he hooks up with these guys, and all they talk about is pimping, right? Like, and pimping the commodification of women, right? Like, using these women. When you read Pimp, and the reason I would never be able to get away with teaching this in my class isn't because it is not of literary value, because it absolutely is. It's a fascinating book with things to say about the world. But when you read it, the first thing that appeals to you is it comes across as extremely voyeuristic. It is entertaining in a trashy way. It is a book with prolonged scenes about sex, prolonged scenes about silence.
Joe, I don't know what this says about me, but for the first time in this podcast history, I am downloading the book right now to Audible. I'm in, baby.
I'm in. Well, and when you read
those are
book,
things that appeal to me.
When you read this book, that's like the initial thrill that you get from it, right? It's one of those things, like that experience that you have just a handful of times in your life, I think, when you start reading and you say, wow, I didn't know a book could be like this, right? I've never seen anything like this before.
In terms of being like extremely pornographic.
Well, and yeah, I mean, pornographic is part of it. It's not that explicitly sexual. Like it's certainly not
erotic. You did just go on about how it was.
Voyeuristic is the way. Like, it gives you a peek into a world that you know nothing about, and a world that's thrilling, right? A world filled with sex, drugs, violence, danger, right? Like,
this
that
is so
world.
Tantalizing, Joe. Do you have any, give us a taste. Do you have any, some of these explicit sex scenes? We'd like to get some clean audio of you just reading them out loud. Do you feel uncomfortable?
Yeah, I don't want to do that.
Are they that explicit?
How do I say
this? Is this book unteachable or unreadable?
No.
Is this a book you would like hide when your grandparents come over?
Yeah. Is this an episode you'd hide from your grandparents?
No, because here's the thing. I do think there's a lot of value in this book. I think there's a ton of value. What I was just thinking is I wondered, so Ian, I would assume you have a bookshelf in your classroom, right? Like a shelf that students could grab books from. I was just wondering if I would keep a copy of this book on my bookshelf for the right student to come across. And I think the answer is no. I think.
Cool. Oh boy.
Well, because here's the thing. I think
Joe's backing up his argument.
Guys, don't read this book. I've changed my mind. Ian, Huckleberry Finn, your turn.
Let me ask a clarifying question.
Yeah.
This book is controversial and has things which are sort of extreme in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
Violence, sexual content. Would you say this book is worth reading because of those things or sort of in spite of those?
I think both. If that's an option. Okay. I think part of what makes this book a blast
to read.
Bullshit
option, but yeah.
Well, no, because I think part of what makes this book a blast to read is that stuff, right? Like that stuff that is just so foreign to the world that I live in, the world that we grew up in. That's absolutely part of it. But also, it is valuable because of those things. So he starts out the book. One of the first things you read is him kind of making this promise. The account of my brutality and cunning will fill many of you with revulsion. And then throughout the text of Pimp, he delivers on that promise. He's absolutely right. There are scenes in this book that are revolting, right? Scenes of sex and violence. However, this book is really structured like a redemption tale. He got out of this life after about 22, 23 years in it. And this book, in a lot of ways, is him writing a book to atone, right? Him writing a book to redeem himself. And he always presents the events of the book in a very straightforward way. It is the story arc of his rise and fall that makes you see these actions in a moralistic light, or in a light in which we can learn a lesson from it.
How do you like reconcile this sort of redemptive arc with the whole it's entertaining in a trashy way? Like it seems like a book that does like all this sort of voyeuristic, like, ooh, look, isn't this crazy? Look at this crap that's happening. And then you get to the end and it's like, hey, all that stuff you enjoyed was actually evil.
Yeah.
Does it condemn the reader for its the voyeurism? That doesn't sound fun to me.
You know, war books do this all the time, right? We're like, we might read a war book because it's kind of cool to read about war. And then, you know, all the famous war books that we read now are kind of horrific. And the takeaway from every war book is, wow, war is really terrible. And I think that's the same sort of thing that's going on here. It draws us in with like this promise and this peek into a world that we don't know anything about. But the thing that we get from it, right, is, oh, wow, that life is really horrible.
I don't understand why you couldn't teach this book.
So so at first, it seems like when you start reading it as a parable, if you stop thinking of it as like whores and pimps, but instead like people who are in control and people who do the working, and you stop thinking about it as in the streets, but maybe working in a large corporation or working in the world, you can see parallels, right? Like you can imagine with your employer kind of being controlled by a combination of love and fear, right? Like we all love our employers to an extent, right? Like our employers provide for us, right?
I love my providers.
Of course, right?
Ian?
Yes. I mean, love is maybe a weird word, but I depend on them, sure. I trust them, yes.
We trust them. They keep us
safe.
Sounds
like I might be a better bottom bitch for my employer than Ian.
We trust our employers, like, to an extent. They keep us safe to an extent. They provide for us, right? And you can see that relationship between whores and pimps. We also are scared of our employers. We're scared of like the wrath that they could bring down us. We're scared of doing a bad job for our employers because of the consequences that we will have, right?
Yeah. The book doesn't get into like, it doesn't clarify these things, right, Joe? Like, it doesn't say, so this is an example of capitalism.
Yeah.
Like,
and then what happens is Sweet puts on his glasses. He gets out the whiteboard. He gets out some Expo markers and he starts drawing some
T-charts. You're probably wondering why I included that section.
You were the pimp the whole time.
But
that's how the book was received, right? Like, people started making these connections.
Yeah. So the thing that, like, the reason that Chris Rock gives this to everybody that he works on a movie with, the reason Dave Chappelle has an entire stand-up special in which he talks in a almost confessional way about this book. I want to talk about this, and that's the idea of this revolt on the white world or this revolt on capitalism. And Chris Rock has come out and said the reason he gives this out as a book, the reason he gives this out as a gift, is because everything you need to know about the way the world works is in this book. And it really does stand as this parable for capitalism. Ice-T created a documentary a few years ago about like the life of Iceberg Slip. By the way, Ice-T, Ice Cube, both took on those monikers as an homage to Iceberg Slim. Like, that's how important this story is in their lives, right? And in it, we talk to Dave Chappelle, we talk to Cat Williams, we talk to Chris Rock, right? And we have all of these black entertainers talking about why this is so important. But if you think about the work that those guys do, if you think about the work that Snoop Dogg does, the work that Dave Chappelle does, the work that Ice-T does, they are creating a piece of, they're taking a piece of black culture, right? And they are packaging it in an appealing way for profit. And some of that profit absolutely goes to them, right? You know, like when Dave Chappelle makes the Chappelle Show, he gets a $50 million contract. But it is also exploitive of the black community, right? And it doesn't just go to them. It goes to Comedy Central. It goes to, right, whatever the production company is, right? Like, it goes to these other places which are not black owned, right? Like, which are a bunch of white dudes sitting around in a boardroom, right? And there has to be this tension between those two things, because when you see Dave Chappelle quitting stand-up, he realizes that he is the bottom bitch for Comedy Central. Right? Like, he is the money earner for Comedy Central, and he is taking this black culture, he is taking this product, and he is getting a piece of it, right? Like, he's absolutely getting paid, he's absolutely getting a piece of it, but it is Comedy Central who is the pimp, and Dave Chappelle is the bitch.
So is that the claim? Like, the kind of the central claim that, like, the world is a prostitution ring, and you can choose one or the other? Is it, like, a philosophical, maybe not explicitly, but, like, is it saying, you know, you have a choice. You can either be in charge or you can be exploited.
100%. Absolutely. Wow. Right. And I think
that's pretty bleak.
It's pretty bleak. And I think when
I think this might be the first time that I've been able to actually hear the physical disdain in Ian's voice for this book that Joe has brought.
Here's the thing.
Ian, tell me about why you hate this book.
Well, okay. So this is a complicated one, because I'm going to talk if I ever get to talk about Huckleberry Finn, I'm going to talk about censorship. And about, like, books that, quote unquote, should not be read. And I'm a firm believer that there's, like, a very small subset of books that, like, are actively bad books. So I'm not going to say that this sounds like a book that people shouldn't read. I'm not going to say that it's a morally condemnable book. It does sound like something which would make me sick to my stomach to read. This is it sounds like a book which perhaps I can see objectively that there might be value to it. And I think it's really fascinating as an object that it has had this huge impact. And I think it is super heartbreaking that he is so apparently concerned with, like, being in control of himself. I even think I'll buy that it's kind of heartbreaking. This is what capitalism, this is what systemic racism does to black men in America. And as you're talking about, like, black bodies being exploited, I was thinking about, like, the NFL, where a lot black men put their lives, literally their lives, on the line, their health, and some of them are compensated quite well, many of them are not. And majority white America watches this sport, football, professional football, as, like, there's a little bit of voyeurism of the violence. So I think there's a lot of resonances. I am not saying that this is a low quality or a worthless book, but I do think I can say, probably for the first time, because Joe, you've brought some amazing books, this is not a book I'm going to be pursuing. It sounds like, for me personally, the reading experience would be too... I would be so kind of caught up on the disgusting elements that I might not be able to get to, wow, this is a harrowing, bleak explication of the nastiness of culture.
I'll counterpoint this.
Yep, go ahead.
It is so outside of my realm of the world. Like, my world. It's so different that I have to read it. I would love to see things from somebody else's perspective.
From the abuser's perspective?
Yeah, why not?
That seems unhealthy.
I'm not endorsing this. My reading this book does not endorse what is in the book. So yeah, I'd love to read this. I think it's such a different worldview.
There is always this element of, even though it's Slim, I think, would say otherwise. Right? Like, I think he absolutely would say otherwise. Nope, this is a cautionary tale. I wrote this to atone for my sins. That's not always the tone that we get in this, right? And there is a tone throughout this. Like, it just comes up in places where it says, look at how smart I was. Not look at how horrible I was, but look at how smart I was. Look at how cunning I was. Look at how manipulative I was. Isn't that cool? And when if this book has left any sour taste in my mouth, it's that. Ian. And it sounds like for you, that would be overt, like that would be obvious. But for me, I'm kind of willing to buy the narrative, right? I'm willing to buy this as a fall from grace and a cautionary tale. But it's just always that shading to it where I think, that's pretty skeezy.
If it's his idea that, like, there are two kinds of people in the world, the dominators and the dominated, then it sounds like what he's doing is saying, here am I. He's trying to play the role of the dominator. And that means that it's dominating, like, the listener. The listener has to either put up with it and say, wow, this is so good, or say, the prospect of reading about a sexually abusive, violent pimp who beats women and is proud of it, who victimizes underage girls, who goes to prison 5 times for things that he definitely did do.
Keep going. Is somebody keeping track? Keep going. This is probably a good time to thank our sponsors. I feel like Joe brought such a dark shroud over not only this episode, but just my soul. Ian, can you take us from this and brighten our day? The young fun adventures of a young lad and oh God, that was, maybe we have to start banning books. Just downers.
Well, let's talk about banning books in a while, because I got some big thoughts about that. But yeah.
Speaking of banned books, tell us about your book, Ian.
Well, yeah, it has been. So I'm gonna start with some kind of like negative quotes to exemplify the negative opinions of this book that people have had. So the Boston Transcript newspaper, which recounts shortly after the publication of Huck Finn, Concord Public Library Committee has decided to exclude Mark Twain's latest book from the library. It contains but little humor, and that of a very coarse type. The veriest trash, rough, coarse, and inelegant, dealing with a series of experiences not elevating, the whole book being more suited to the slums than to intelligent, respectable people. Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Women, a well-known best-selling children's author or young adult fiction author, if Mr. Clemens cannot think of something better to tell our pure-minded lads and lasses, he had best stop writing for them. So these are pretty bad. Mark Twain was very much on record as saying...
Haters.
Yeah, haters gonna hate. Mark Twain
Did Marky Mark have a lot of haters?
Some. I mean, people kind of... By the time he wrote Huck Finn, he was pretty well-respected. This is kind of like coming at a high point in his career. But he was very much on record as saying, this is not a book. I didn't write this book for kids. Like, they have kids in them, but they're not like a little fun little kids book. There's like some serious grown-up stuff that it deals with. On the other side, so let me give you some kind of like positive readings of it. Kurt Vonnegut said that Huckleberry Finn is as good as comically profound as Don Quixote, which is widely known as widely considered to be the first novel ever written. Ernest Hemingway said, all modern American literature comes from one book by Mark Twain called Huckleberry Finn. It's the best book we've had. All American writing comes from that. There was nothing before. There has been nothing as good since. Now, Hemingway is a bit of a blowhard. Not sure I would buy that. There's been some good stuff other than Huck Finn, but T.S. Eliot says this is the only one of Mark Twain's books which can be called a masterpiece. It is the only one in which his genius is completely realized and the only one which creates its own category.
I have actually never read this book.
Okay. It's a weird book because it's the format is what's called picaresque. So this is not picturesque. This is a different word, picaresque.
Are you just mispronouncing it?
No, I'm not.
Is that like a Southern accent?
This book is called Picaresque, it's so pretty. No, it's
that
not.
That was a terrible Southern accent.
It's I know. Really good.
Haven't lived in the South for almost three decades. Anyway,
yeah.
Instead of having like a single sort of like rising arc of building action where everything kind of contributes to this, it is instead sort of a series of experiences along a journey. So we might say that some books that we're familiar with already have this. So a book like The Hobbit does have kind of like an overarching goal, which is to get to the lonely mountain. And here's your Hobbit fact for the day. The Elvish name for the Lonely Mountain is Erebor. So there we go. I'm just throwing that in there.
It's a real quick one.
Yeah, just a little parenthetical Hobbit fact. But so like there are certain books which kind of have this like things happen along the way, but there is a overall sort of aim that they're moving towards. Picaresque novels are much more like someone's on a journey and you know something's weird stuff is going to happen to them, but you don't know what. They don't know what. And so you don't get the sense that like we're building to a final confrontation with a man who shot my father, or, you know, we're going to throw the ring in Mount Doom or whatever it is. There's much more of like, man, we're out on a journey. It's a road trip.
Things happening.
It's just like stuff happens. Stuff happens to you out there. This young fella, Huckleberry Finn, travels from his town in Missouri down the Mississippi River, and he is traveling with an escaped slave named Jim. They're on a raft and various things happen to them, and they fall in with a couple of con men who are just kind of funny, but also the absolute worst. So Huckleberry Finn kind of starts off being pretty racist because like he's a young man in the sort of South. Missouri was part of like the South at that point. He's pretty racist and he thinks of Jim as like less than a person. He's like, it is my moral responsibility to return this escaped slave to their owner. And over the course of the novel, Huckleberry Finn realizes that Jim is a person. Jim has feelings. Jim is good. Jim should not be enslaved. Jim should be free. And at the end of the novel, there is this moment where Huck says,
slavery bad.
Yeah, he says slavery bad. He says, but specifically he says, like, he doesn't even say that, though. He says, he has a moral choice. And he believes that, like, he's been told it is sinful. You will go to hell if you help slaves kind of escape and be free. And he says, I don't care. I'll go to hell. And he helps Jim make his final escape. And that's this moment when it's like Huck gets to this point where he's so kind of pressed in by these forces that shape who he is. And yet he takes this stand. He says, I don't care what happens to me. I'm going to do what I think is the right thing to help this guy out.
I love it.
Yeah.
Do you think Mark Twain is the most quotable person to ever live?
It's gotta be. He's so good.
Nobody's even coming close.
So good. Like Yogi Berra? I think he understood.
Yogi Bear?
Oh.
Yogi Bear.
Yeah. Could be. He understood the value of saying things briefly and fun, which is something that I think we in this podcast also really appreciate.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you have any insight on why this book was banned so much?
Yes.
And like why it was unteachable?
Right.
And why people like to burn it.
Okay, so it's funny because there have been two different reasons why people have banned it and why it's been considered unteachable. As I read those early ones, those early reviews, people were saying this is crude. Famously, there was one, I think it's a Brooklyn Public Library, chose not to carry it because, let me get the quote here, he says, they said, Huckleberry Finn both itches and scratches himself. And... that's vulgar. They were like, this is vulgar and obscene, which was, I mean, it's 100, it was 1905. So a long time ago, different
that's
standards.
Such a classic 1905 quote.
That is good.
It was very much a vibe of like, this is vulgar. This is beneath us. This is not edifying to young people's pure minds. And no matter how much Mark Twain would say like, no, I didn't write this for kids. I didn't write this for kids. Don't give it to your kids. Stop giving it to your kids.
Why?
Please.
I told you like six times not to give this to your kids.
And they kept giving it to their kids.
Why
it's
do you keep
it's still considered like people talk about it. I read it when I was young. People talk about it like it's a young, a so juvenile book.
Somebody gave it to you too.
Well, okay. Part of that though, Ian, is like, have you read Tom Sawyer?
Yeah.
Tom Sawyer is a juvenile book, isn't it?
It kind of is, right?
Yeah, it's kind of this quick little fun story about like this boy who tricks people into actually right. There's a larger plot about like right. treasure, but yeah, but it is this kid's book.
Twain kind of hurt his case by saying, "I also didn't intend Tom Sawyer to be a children's book," but that's just foolishness because it's so clearly so. Like, there's this reason, right? This is one of the reasons why he was banned, that it was vulgar and crude. And then later, much later, there was a concern that its representation of pre-Civil War Southern culture was unpleasant for people
right.
and hurtful. And this is a big part of why I couldn't teach it. Now, I know you said kind of off air that you teach it, Joe.
Yes.
And I'm not saying it's unteachable. I'm saying, given my student population and given sort of the requirement for a ton of background work and probably maybe an expurgated edition, an edition that doesn't use the N-word, like
sure.
you would need to do, because like this is the thing. I'm not saying this is a book I wouldn't recommend, but when you right. give a book to someone and you're teaching it, you're requiring them to read it. You're saying, your grade and your success in school depends on A, how well you can lie about reading this book, or B, how well like you read this book. And I don't think right. I'm comfortable, especially with my students of color who maybe have had to, who I know have had to deal with racism. I'm not sure I'm comfortable saying I'm going to require you to read this story where white people are pretty nasty and racist. Now, it's not a racist right. book. I think it's an anti-racist book, and there are a lot of people who agree with me, but it's a book which represents this racism in a realistic way that like it's not like Tom Sawyer.
It would be very simple to like to quote this book out of context.
There is a genre, a budding genre of satires of racism. So did either of you guys see the movie Sorry to Bother You, Boots Riley, a couple years ago?
I've seen The Chappelle Show. That's a satire of racism.
Yeah. But like
I've seen The Chappelle Show.
A lot of times, satires of racism kind of express things in a very sort of, there's an excess to it. It's like, I'm thinking of Inglourious Basterds, where like, right. it's just absolutely ludicrous and nonsensical. And racism is this thing which is disgusting in caricatured excess. And what this book does is kind of like, it doesn't do that, really. It goes for this sort of scathing realism, where you have a sense that these could actually be real racist people that Huck Finn and Jim encounter as they kind of make their way down the Mississippi River. And so what this means is it's not as easy to see that it's satire. You kind of have to look for it, and you have to understand sort of what the whole, like Joe says, what the whole book is doing. There's a character, a character in the novel who is very kind to Huck Finn, but she's a total racist. And like is totally fine with them hunting down Jim, and like it's kind of hard. It's more difficult to see these characters that have good elements but are in fact terrible.
Yeah, yep,
it introduces this nuance.
So I guess I have a question. So you talk about like not wanting to show this to your students or not wanting the. I'm
not going to require it. I certainly would. Like, if my student came to me and said, "I want to write a paper about American novels that changed the landscape of fiction,"
yep.
or whatever, American yep. novels about rivers, I would absolutely recommend this. I would say right. this is an amazing book. It's very good. And then I would
One
say,
the
listen, they're super cruel. They're super cruel to the enslaved person who escapes and is central to the book. Because I wouldn't want my students to like walk into me like, "Oh, wait, what? Oh, that's like," and especially if it's required. That's yeah.
Yeah. So I think the idea of it being required is interesting, because I think like the counter argument for what you're talking about here is, but what if I said to you, Ian, that's just Twain presenting the South as it was? Like, isn't that just an honest depiction of the South?
Sure. And again, let me emphasize, I'm I think this is a great book and I would 100% recommend it. And I think if I were teaching teaching a class, say, where we could focus on, you know, how we read white people writing about racism, or how we read, you know, pre-civil rights, anti-racist books, if we had the framework for it, I might assign it. But just sort of like assigning it in the classes that I teach, the populations that I teach, in the situation that I teach, this would need a good bit of scaffolding, a good bit of framing.
Can I read you guys a review?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Because I'd love to get your response, Ian, because I think this is obviously a really rich book with just a lot of... All right, let's get to the review. So this is from... It's from Modesto. All right,
from who
one
now?
Star.
Sorry, who now?
Modesto.
Is it a person
Modesto?
Or a place?
It's a Modesto,
place in California.
California.
The whole city got together and wrote a review together.
Oh yeah, here it says the city of Modesto. Sorry, it
happens a lot in thing. California. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
All right, so the city of Modesto gave this a one star. All right,
oof.
I want your response.
Yep.
It was the best book I've ever read. Fantastic.
One star.
One star. How do you argue against this?
I think this person was playing, doing golf rules where you give as few stars as possible.
Gotcha. Hole in one.
Well, you mentioned cities. There's my segue. And this has been like 140 years after it was published. It pops back up with various school districts or cities trying to ban it. And one of the more recent ones I saw, a teacher was kind of leading the charge on it. He said, I think there are better books to teach in school. And I think there might be some legitimacy to that. I'm not a big fan of banning books in general, because a lot of times this is a way you kind of suppress alternative viewpoints. This is why I say, like, even though I don't like the idea of Pimp, I personally wouldn't read it. I don't know that I would support banning it, because when you ban something, it's like saying these ideas are bad ideas. And I think
isn't it a great way of ensuring, though, that history never repeats itself?
If you ban books, yeah, exactly.
Banning different points of view.
Exactly. So we've got this central character. We've got, well, T.S. Eliot says there's these two central characters, the boy and the river. And so Huck is this central character, and he's this such a solid point of view protagonist. He deals with really, really crazy stuff. And his viewpoint on it is so psychologically real. It's so legit, understandable. Like, he reacts to the things the ways that we think we might react to things. He has been trained by his society to believe that it is not just like wise, efficient, but also like morally good for black people to be enslaved. And this is a voyage of discovery, really, of self-discovery, where Huck kind of goes down the river, realizes, feels himself changing in his views of Jim, and ends up respecting, valuing, appreciating Jim in ways that he could not have. He kind of throws off the sort of training he's been given. He's like, yeah, Jim is a person, which seems like a kind of a paltry discovery to make. But for a book published in 1885, set in the 1850s, that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, and I think this genre, like this, and it's hard to put Huck Finn in a genre, but if you talk about it as a genre of a child narrator, right, encountering hard truths about the world, that's a well-rehearsed genre, maybe not at the time, but since then. And I think it's such an effective one. Like, we think of the movie like Stand By Me, for example, or we think of the book Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which is this child narrator, this 8-9-year-old narrator who is dealing with the 9/11 attacks, right?
Right.
And there's something about seeing the world, you know, I mean, it's all the way back to Hans Christian Andersen, and, you know, from the mouths of babes come truth. There's something about seeing the world through a child's eyes that can be very revealing. It's almost like, do you ever notice how when you're in your house, it doesn't seem that messy? And then somebody texts you and they tell you that they're going to stop over, and suddenly you see it through their eyes and your house is a disaster. I think that is valuable in these books.
Did you guys know that huckleberries are a real thing and you cannot grow them? Like, you can't cultivate them agriculturally.
They're wild.
Yeah. And you have to, they will not grow. They will not produce fruit if you plant them from seed. So they live.
Is that such a metaphor for Huck Finn? I mean, come on.
It is. I don't think Twain was doing that, because I don't know. Maybe. I don't think
maybe,
so.
Maybe, yeah.
But like they only grow in like the mountains in wild native soil. And if you want to try and like have a huckleberry farm, you can't. You have to That's know where they grow in the mountains and go pick them. And they only live kind of in the northern.
Right.
So that's the whole thing about huckleberries.
They refuse to be civilized. They cannot be cultivated.
Yep. It's really good. Dang it. Why didn't I think of that? So good.
Yeah, really good.
Joe, you should have presented this book. Well, Joe, I was wondering, maybe you could talk just a little bit about why, like how you teach it and why you teach it, like why it's important that you, because you've said you teach this in your American Lit class.
Yeah. Well,
here's another connection between the character and the fruit. I think you guys might want to hear this.
Yep.
They are small, round berries resembling blueberries.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and there's so many like depictions of like Huck rolling off the raft because he's small and round. And there's a moment when like Jim almost steps on him because he thinks he's stepping on a blueberry. But yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And when Jim was about to take a big bite of a sandwich and he accidentally bites into Huck and he's like, "Oh, you are red in tartan flavor."
So when people talk about this book as racist, I'm with Ian. I think that is almost indefensible, right? Like if you say that Huckleberry Finn is a racist book, I will tell you that you have a severe misunderstanding of Huckleberry Finn, right? There's something, you're missing the boat on this one. Yeah. You're missing the raft.
Yeah. Nice. Missing however, the raft. That's good.
Yeah. I don't get it.
Anyway, go ahead.
However, like this book absolutely needs to be taught with some tough conversations about the use of language, about race, about
like Huckleberry Finn says the N-word. You got to say, you can't say this. And you got to say, when you're reading sections out loud, you may not use this word.
Would you say that to your
class? Yeah, I would. Because apparently this is a thing. This is a habit that some white students have. Studying literature which depicts racism or slavery, white students like to, and I'm generalizing here, but this is based on like a variety of conversations I've had with various people who have taught books like this. White students like to read quotes out loud, which have the N-word in them because it's okay to say it. It's like an excuse to say it. It's horrifying.
It is a pass, right? Yeah. Because all of a sudden, I didn't say it, Huck said it, or I didn't say it, Twain said it, or I didn't say it, Huck said it, right? And I'm just reading Huck's quote. And quoting a Dave Chappelle show, or I'm singing along to this song that I like.
So there has been a move in the last probably 20 years to publish expurgated versions of this text.
Yeah.
So the racial slurs turned to the N-word becomes slave, which isn't great, but it's you can read that out loud in a classroom without hurting people.
Absolutely.
Would you, if you had, let's say you like for free, you got copies of these, it wasn't an issue with like buying the books, the curriculum was off the table. Like if you got these, would you rather teach an expurgated edition? Would that make you feel better about teaching this? Like, would you feel more comfortable teaching this book if you didn't have to deal with the N-words and there are racial slurs for Native Americans too?
Yeah. I think this is such a hard question.
And don't help him, Ian. Let's see how he answers.
You're good. I'm good.
So when I see that there's an expurgated edition,
yeah,
part of me, like, I hate that. There's part of me that absolutely hates that because I say, like, and I don't know if it's as an English teacher, as somebody who likes literature, or it feels dishonest to me.
Yeah.
And I understand why it happens. Right. Like I think the reason it happens is because of the things that we're talking about here, because of the why it's difficult to teach this book. Right. I understand why it happens, but it feels dishonest to the narrative. It feels dishonest to Huck's world. And I think it, no pun here, it whitewashes the world. Right. It whitewashes the world that Huck lives in.
It's hard to not appreciate that pun, Joe.
But does that make it easier to teach? Absolutely. But if you gave me those two books, right, mm-hmm. and you said, okay, you're teaching Huck Finn this year, you have a choice. You can teach this one that as Twain wrote it, right? Or you could teach this expurgated one. My response would be, I want to teach the one how Twain wrote it And that has to be a conversation in my classroom about why we're teaching that one.
Right. Yeah.
And obviously the fear is that I can't do that conversation justice. That maybe my background, maybe my attitude, maybe my thoughts, my biases, whatever. Maybe I am by definition incapable of teaching that. But I think it would be my responsibility to A, present the work as it's meant to be read, right? Present that dirty, gritty, raw world, right? And talk offline or talk in that classroom about like, hey, this is why we're doing it. We had a choice. This is why I'm doing this one, because it's faithful to that world. It's faithful to the literature, et cetera. I don't know how popular of an opinion that is.
Right. Like this book loses very, I think this book loses very little in expurgation. I think the risk of doing serious hurt damage to our students. I'm not judging kind of where Joe's deciding to go. I'm saying for myself, the risk of doing serious hurt to my students, and some of them have told me their experiences with racism, and they are horrible, like really heart-wrenching, heartbreaking experiences with people discriminating against them, calling them like slurs, calling children hardcore slurs. Mm-hmm. I don't think I want my class to be requiring material. I would put this on my shelf to recommend to students. I wouldn't require it of students.
I think the argument of requiring something is one that I haven't heard before, Ian, and it's persuasive to me, right? Because it totally changes the nature of the beast as soon as students have to do it.
Right.
Shit. It's a real tough one, isn't it? It's a real pickle. I really get it. It's really terrible. I guess there's plenty of books in the river, right? I mean, can't we? Let's just pick a different one to teach it, huh?
Well, but this is something. So one of you said
plenty of books.
One of you said something about like teaching it because of its influence, and this is a problem that this is probably agreed on as the best book by Mark Twain. And Mark Twain is agreed on as one of the best authors in the American fiction tradition. So
this book is frequently talked about as the great American novel. Like if you say the great American novel, name it. There's only a handful of books that end up on that list, and this one is up there.
Here's the question: does this book inherently are like any lesson you would learn about like racism, inequality, and like you know unlikely friendships and crossing bridges and all that kind of stuff, or building bridges? Like, is that what you get out of this book?
Okay, oh my god.
Or is that just the conversation around the book?
No, this is so hard.
Because if that's not what you get out of it, fuck this book. Right?
Oh, you're asking.
So answer the question.
Does it actually like teach you something?
About specific to racism.
Yeah, I think it does. It's hopeful. It offers the possibility of someone leaving behind their being taught, learning that their prejudices are hurtful and hateful. I think it's really, really hopeful, because Huck is your classic white redneck bully.
And that's not to be offensive towards rednecks.
No, rednecks are fine.
I just wanted to put that disclaimer in there.
Through a variety of things that happened to him, he is forced to realize that his sort of racist approach is hurtful, is hateful, and he leaves it behind. He makes a concrete decision that, all right, then I'll go to hell. This is a concrete decision to say, you know what, I have arrived at a place personally where I am changed by what I've gone through.
And when you read this book, I think it's impossible to not make that decision along with Huck. Because Jim, you know, we see Jim, Ian talked about this, one of the first things he said, we see him move from an object and an obstacle to a fully realized flesh and blood human being. And not just a fully realized flesh and blood human being, but probably the most admirable character in this book. Right. Like Jim is sad about leaving his wife. Jim cries. Jim loves and protects Huck. Like, we see all of Jim's emotions. We see all of Jim's decisions in an extremely positive light, in pretty stark contrast to, for example, like Huck's dad, who's a total piece of shit and doesn't love Huck and uses Huck for like manipulative gain. right? So you not only does Huck make this decision and is there value in that, but it is impossible to read this book and not also make that decision.
Yeah, I agree. Like Joe says, you get to the end and you're like, yep, this is where he's at. It makes total sense. And we are along for the ride. We are floating down the river on this raft.
So Ian, I feel like you should win, but I'm concerned about any quote that you would read.
No, I've got a really good quote, actually.
Give us your quote. All right. Don't make me bleep you.
I won't. No, I'm not going to bleep. So this is the very, very beginning of the adventures of Huckleberry Finn. So the way the book looks is you got your title page, you got your table of contents. This is the first content of the book. Notice: persons attempting to find a motive in this narrative will be prosecuted. Persons attempting to find a moral in it will be banished. Persons attempting to find a plot in it will be shot. By order of the author.